Hello, Eric. Huddled under the stage opposite was an unbelievable sight. Seven of the most beautiful girls in the world, stunning in white feathered angel costumes. The crew could hardly take their eyes off them. Is this heaven? I asked a stagehand, who was staring at them open-mouthed. Oh, yes, he said. Funny, they don't look like virgins to me. Odd how a gag can calm you before you face the storm. I'm in a hole under a stage in the centre of the Olympic Stadium. Suddenly the wooden ceiling slides open. We're getting close now. I can hear my old pal Jeff Lynn singing on the PA, Mr. Blue Sky. My cue to move. I'm led forward and crouch at the foot of some low stairs. Now I can see above me a huge circus cannon. A man dressed identically to me climbs in. The cannon fires, he tumbles out of the mouth of the cannon and falls into the hole in the ground. Unseen mattresses break his fall. Time to go over the top. A voice in my ear says, "Here it comes," then, "Cue Eric." I'm on. I wait a beat, make sure the cameras have had time to focus. I pull myself up groggily into the brilliant lights. "Some things in life are bad, they can really make you mad." The crowd roars in surprise as they see me. "And always look on the bright side of life." Too fast, the audience has taken off ahead of me. I concentrate on bringing them back to the tempo of the track. In one ear, I can hear the orchestral backing. In the other, annoyingly, the director talking me through every move. Shut the fuck up, I'm thinking, so I can hear the damn track. I have never done this in-ear singing before. I want him to be quiet so I can hear the band, but there's nothing I can do. I have to keep going. The audience is singing along joyfully now. I've managed to slow them down. Now we're all in sync. I turn to the lovely models who have risen up behind me. They're supposed to react to me, but they are frozen, staring glassy-eyed at the spectacle of a packed arena filled with lights. Move on. I skip around 150 Welshmen from a male voice choir dressed in traditional Welsh female costume, a reference to the Money Song, the first number I ever sang on Python. I skip and dance around a chorus of 550 singers and dancers. I skirt the skating nuns, another Python reference. "Turn right, Eric," says the annoying voice in my ear. "I know that. For fuck's sake, shut up." There's a whole new lyric coming up about the Olympics. Mustn't forget the words. I've only been rehearsing them in my head for months. When you're stuck on the world stage with lots of weirdos half your age and everything is starting to go wrong, it's too late to run away, so you might as well just stay, especially if they play your silly song. Nailed it. Over the dangerous bits now. Ahead, my favourite moment. 40 Bangla dancers come racing in. Great idea of our directors. Thank you, Kim Gavin. They lift me up and sprinkle me with holi, throwing dry coloured paint at me. "Remember to throw it hard," I said to them before the show. "It's only funny when it hurts." They do. It does. Now this dry paint is in my mouth, in my eyes. I'm blinded, I'm choking, I'm lifted off the ground and manhandled. But it feels funny. I recover my voice as they set me down, and there ahead of me is my Britannia, soprano Susan Bullock, who was with me in Jonathan Miller's Mikado at the E&O. She heads towards me, and I grab her hand gratefully. Nearly there. "And always look on the bright side of life." I am led away, blinded by the paint and deafened by the earbuds. I stumble towards the exit and pull out my plugs. Sue is beaming. "How did it go?" I say. She looks at me wonderingly. "Really?" The stadium is still applauding. I guess it went okay then. I head for the showers, enjoying that blessed moment in show business when it's over. Only afterwards, as all of the performers gathered together upstairs, did it feel better. I said to the Who, "You know who we are. We are the sort of people who will work for nothing." True, too. Every single major rock star was supposed to attend, but found the financial rewards unattractive. Of course, it wasn't really nothing. It was a pound. I kid you not. They wouldn't even pay for airfare. Even that quid wasn't easy to come by. It took 3 months of negotiations with an expensive LA lawyer, and they produced a 300-page contract I had to sign, giving them, well, everything. One of the clauses required me to insure the audience against any act of terror or physical harm during my performance. When Tom Hoberman, my lawyer, asked how I could possibly afford that, they said blandly that most acts carry such insurance. When John Cleese and I toured, the most we could guarantee was that they would be offended. And there were no cars after the show. For all those glamorous performers, they had arranged a bus. I think that was the clincher for Elton. A bus ride home? For Elton? He dropped out. Actually, the bus turned out to be surprisingly good fun, because Tanya brilliantly arranged with the caterers to stuff it with champagne. And it became quite a party, and we did get very rowdy. Lily tells me the young people I partied with all the way home were amazingly famous. One Direction and Elbow and such. They partied on when we reached our hotel, but for me, blissful sleep. Of course, the Olympic Committee never even paid the pound. Some months later, I decided to call them on this and got my California lawyer to send them a letter demanding immediate payment of the fee of £1. They did see the humour of this and sent a letter of apology with a £1 coin sellotape to it. I told Tom, my lawyer, that instead of his usual percentage, he could keep the entire fee. So, yes, he has the whole pound proudly framed in his office. I'm generous like that. Chapter 29, The Last Laugh. The Python Reunion, O2 Arena, London, July 2014. Of course, we said we'd never do it. It could never happen. It wouldn't be possible. We were too old, Graham was still dead, until he came back, we would wait. What we hadn't foreseen is we would all be in our 70s and £1 million in debt. So the Python Reunion was really thanks to the man who pursued us for 7 years in a free partnership with a lawyer looking for ways to get more money out of Python's income from Spamalot. A success of any sort always brings people crawling out of the woodwork, and Spamalot was no exception. But I must say I was surprised when one of the producers of the Holy Grail sued us, despite the huge amounts of money we'd already given him. In the end, it cost us over £1 million in legal fees simply to defend ourselves. And even though he'd lost or abandoned most of his claims by the time the trial began, surprisingly, the judge accepted his one extraordinary claim that we had promised to treat him as the seventh python. As if. Despite the fact his contract said otherwise, and that Mike, Terry J, and I testified in court that it was nonsense, and John Cleese gave a scathing deposition that he had more chance of being considered the fourth Kennedy brother than the seventh python, the judge shocked us when he upheld this claim. As I said at the time, it has restored my faith in British injustice. But we were still £1 million in debt. I tracked down my old friend Jim Beach, now cunningly spinning queen round the world with Adam Lambert, and asked him if he'd come to London for an emergency Python meeting and give us his advice. He flew in from Switzerland, listened to our story, and delivered his professional opinion. "You're totally fucked," he said. "However," he added, "if you played one night live at O2, you could pay this debt off immediately." There was a very swift response. "Yes," we all said. So the final Python reunion began. Our promoter, Phil McIntyre, immediately persuaded us to do 5 shows. Might as well, we thought, although John was very doubtful we could sell that many seats. Since everyone was busy, I volunteered to put the script together and direct the show, and pissed off to the country to work on it. I asked everyone to let me know which sketches they wanted to do for the last time, and had some interesting responses. John chose Gumby Brain Specialist, which we rehearsed but cut before opening. I set to work to create a show with corkboards, cards, and coloured Sharpies. My problem was the O2. It's a huge arena. Even if we were on big screens, we would still be dwarfed by the sheer size of the stadium. I didn't want our final appearance to look like a rip-off of our last live outing at the Hollywood Bowl 30 years earlier, or simply be bad. This was the Python farewell. It simply had to be good. And different. But how? Fortunately, my Broadway experience came to the rescue. Of course, it had to be a musical show, with a big band and lots of singers and dancers to surround us ancient septuagenarians with energy and dancing. That way we could do popular Python songs, some publicly for the first time. And more important, I could add the amazing Arlene Phillips as choreographer, so she could recreate Every Sperm is Sacred, which she had done so brilliantly in the Meaning of Life movie. Having Arlene and her tireless energy made all the difference. Now we had a real show, with a live orchestra and singers and dancers. We could do a big final version of Lumberjack, sung by Michael, and end up with Always Look on the Bright Side of Life as a grand finale. I linked things together, as in the old Python days, Yorkshire Minor, Into the Blackets, Into the Pope, Into Every Sperm is Sacred, etc. When I returned to London for the read-through, it was a love fest. The Pythons were all very pally, greeting familiar faces in the packed room. I'd realised we must have Carol Cleveland. Of course, she really was a seventh Python, and had been with us all those times on the road. In a tiny packed hotel room off St. James's, we read the script aloud to our new department heads, stage designers, set designers, costume designers, including the wonderful Hazel Pethick, our original wardrobe lady. Choreographer, wig makers, lighting designer, sound, video, musical director, John Dupre, Natch, and producers. The read-through went very well, and the Pythons requested only one change. John wanted to cut the Yorkshire Minor sketch, which, though one of my favourites, was fine by me. I was happy they liked the script. We did a day of press announcements and interviews, and then appeared on the Graham Norton show with a slightly tipsy John, who was very naughty after sneaking a sly vodka in the green room. Inevitably, another two TV documentaries were commissioned, one by Alan Yentob for the BBC, and another that would follow the making of the show with backstage access. The first inkling we had that something very exciting was happening came while I was working in my hotel room with Arlene and John Dupre on the musical numbers. Holly Gilliam, Terry's younger daughter, and one of the Python managers, rang to say that the tickets had gone on sale and that they had sold out in 34 seconds. What? They were immediately releasing the tickets for the next four shows. She called back. Those had all sold out in 30 minutes. What the hell? Now they were asking, would we consider doing five more shows? Holy shit! We were thrilled and a little humbled, and went back to our meeting. We'd better be good, I said. The first stage design was a disaster. It was a high-tech rock and roll set with multiple levels and stages rising and descending from below. The thought of any of the Pythons falling into one of those holes during a blackout was insupportable. The show would be over instantly. So I suggested low roll-out platforms with sets built behind, all on one level, with a high bridge for dancers, no holes to fall into, and the Gilliam-esque Victorian cut-out theatre look. Rick Lipson and Stewfish, the amazing design company, did a fantastic job. Their new set looked great, like a child's toy theatre, incorporating an enormous central screen for film and animation, plus two side screens for live close-ups. It wasn't cheap, but then again, we were inundated with offers to tour the world. Directing the show took up most of my time from September to July. Unfortunately, because they were all busy, I would only get the Pythons 2 weeks before the first performance. We would get just 3 days of us alone in a rehearsal room to work on the sketches. And then we would be on to our big stage, rigged up in Acton, in a large rehearsal space with all the video and lighting and sound crews present. Knowing this time limitation, I had doubles for all the Pythons, so we could rehearse their entrances, exits, and blocking with the dancers. It meant, too, that lighting could have something to focus on, and the video projectors could learn their cues. When they appeared on set for the first time, they had someone to hold their hand and walk them around for their individual cues. This was good, as the set was huge, and the costume changes quick and complicated. I also wanted an invited audience for 3 nights up in Acton so we could at least get used to playing together again, and the whole company could get the feel of a live show. Fortunately, I had great help from my assistant director, the indefatigable and tireless CJ Ranger, and of course the delightful and always supportive Arlene Phillips. Before the pythons came in, I spent an incredible June day filming on the banks of the Cam by King's College with Stephen Hawking and Professor Brian Cox under a perfect cerulean Cambridge sky. Brian and I had been friends since he came to a recording of What About Dick in L.A. He was a northerner like me from Oldham, where my parents had married. When my mum came to visit me on the set of Baron Munchausen in Rome, I said, "Mum, Rome is built on seven hills." "Oh," she replied, "just like Oldham." Brian and I shared a love of cosmology, champagne and Chinese food, which we found went well together. We could talk for hours, because he knows everything and I know nothing, which of course doesn't stop me arguing. Once you get to the universe and whether life in it is common or unique, you leave the realms of science for philosophy, and I can bullshit philosophy with the best of them. Immanuel Kant was a real piss and was very rarely stable. Heidegger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. I've always loved the fact that the wonderful Christopher Hitchens knew every word of the Bruce's Philosopher's Song and would often sing it publicly at the end of his talks. You can see him do it on YouTube. Professor Brian, so called to distinguish himself from the actor Brian Cox, whose twinkling buttocks we once saw bouncing naked in a kilt running full pelt towards a castle in Scotland, would always complain that my lyrics to the Galaxy Song were wrong. I kept telling him that they were scientifically correct 35 years ago, and it was science that had changed. More precise measurements have been made since then, but these figures were accurate for 1982, when we wrote the song. But even though I updated them, he still wouldn't have it. The sun is not the source of all our power. There is uranium in the core of the earth. Yes, but there wouldn't be uranium there but for the sun. That's not true. Well, there wouldn't be a solar system for it to be in but for the sun. He wasn't having any of it, so I decided to tease him and wrote a film piece for him where immediately after I sing the Galaxy Song, he appears on screen complaining about my lyrics on the riverbank at King's College. In the middle of his complaint, he's run over by Stephen Hawking in his wheelchair. Brian is such a good sport, he was totally up for this. He emailed Stephen to ask if he would consider doing it, and Stephen immediately responded yes. So there we were, shooting this gag on the banks of the Cam. We used a stunt double for Stephen for the actual running over of Brian, although he himself fell gamely and perfectly 8 times like a pro. We then went to Stephen's incredible modern Cambridge science department to film him against green screen with wind ruffling his hair. While we were talking to him, Stephen was busy writing something. He then played it back. "Way too pedantic," he had ad-libbed. Luckily, we were filming him and we used that line on the audio after he runs over Brian. In the car, on the way home, Brian said, "We just spent a whole day filming with one of the most extraordinary minds on the planet, and all we did was a silly gag." "Brilliant," I said. Professor Hawking came to the final night at O2. There was a huge laugh as he ran over Brian on screen, then a laugh at his own line, and applause as he set off into space in his wheelchair singing the Galaxy Song. In 2015, with his permission, we released a special single version of him singing the song. When he died in 2018, that image of him singing in space was all over the internet. Now, at O2, we stuck a spotlight on him, and the whole place exploded. They cheered him to the rafters. It was so moving it made me cry, and when his nurse raised his arm to wave and acknowledge the applause, I felt the hair stand up on the back of my neck. After the show, he came backstage to the party and seemed really happy to be there. I said to him, "I think you, me and Professor Cox have a great future in comedy." Before we opened, thanks to our lighting guru Patrick Woodruff, Mick and the Stones released a wonderful video ad-lib rant about the sheer nerve of wrinkled British oldies coming out of retirement, charging exorbitant prices to gouge the public. A video so funny and accurate that many newspapers altogether missed it was a gag. On July the 1st, 2014, 18,000 people were packed into the impossibly vast space of the O2 Arena for opening night, the first of 10 sold-out shows. We were there by the skin of our teeth. Now were we ready. We were ushered into our slightly renamed TARDIS as the overture began to play. We sang along quietly, each in our own thoughts, Terry G. giggling nervously. "Oh, shut up, Gilliam," said John to his old friend and bete noir. They opened the door and sprayed smoke on us. Might as well have been gas. I felt incredibly close to these four men, dressed as Mexican mariachi players, accompanied, of course, by a kangaroo, the rather brilliant Samuel Holmes, whom we had co-opted from Spamalot. God knows what he must have been thinking. We heard the overture ending and the audience yelling in anticipation. The TARDIS was shoved forward onto the enormous stage. "Here we go!" The doors open. Jonesy bursts out in front of me. The crowd goes wild. We step forward into the bright lights, basking in the shower of love. Anticipating we wouldn't be able to start speaking for quite some time amidst the loud response from the audience, I had put in a pacing moment right here. "Photo opportunity," it said behind us, triggering thousands of cell phones, blistering into flash as we posed. A vast wave of sound, a huge bark of approval. We're back. Though it had cost a lot, I was confident we could amortize this expense on the road, because we had strongly tempting offers for tours of the US, Australia, and South Africa. Michael Palin, however, was not keen and nixed all proposals. That was certainly his right, although some taller members were a little cross, especially when he immediately set off on a solo tour of Australia. But I understand what Mike felt. Backstage one night, with both of us dressed in glam drag for camp judges, he had said, "This has been fun, but we don't want to keep on doing this, do we, Al?" I knew what he meant. It was fun, but come show 87, and where are we again tonight? I didn't fancy it that much either. So when it became clear that we would not be doing any more, I suggested to Jim Beach that we make the last night a big worldwide event, screening live on TV and in cinemas all round the globe. I liked the idea of doing a final show. We still liked each other, we had had a lot of fun, and we'd made thousands of people very happy. Terry J's memory was fading fast, and I think that was the smartest way to end. It seemed classier than petering out in Peterborough or Cleveland, and so the metaphorical curtain came down on Monty Python on July the 20th, 2014. 18,000 people for 10 nights at London's O2 Arena had come to see us live on stage, performing together again for the first time since the Hollywood Bowl in 1980. The final night was live on TV and in selected theatres around the world. You couldn't have written a better exit than us all singing "Always Look on the Bright Side of Life" for the very last time together. It was a fine farewell to Monty Python. Chapter 30, The Speed of Life. Shortly after our final show, we learned the terrible news that our friend, the wonderful, funny, extraordinary Robin Williams, was dead. And, unbelievably, by his own hand. I will never be reconciled to his death, but I will remain forever grateful for his life. He brought me so much joy, so much laughter. For 34 years he was my pal. Nobody was ever quite like Robin. He was sui generis, which is Latin for fuck off and don't be pretentious. I first saw him in May 1980 in a seedy ex-strip club in Soho, where he was inviting a British audience to pray for the death of a heckler. The previous comedian, Alexis Sale, had fought desperately against a loud, drunk, aggressive crowd, and had virtually given up. "But," he said with a twinkle, "I have a secret weapon." Did he ever? He brought on Robin, who from the moment he bounced on stage turned this dangerous, hostile crowd into a docile chorus of grateful adorers, who hung on his every line and laughed at his every riff. I've never seen a funnier man. It's as if Einstein suddenly decided, "Fuck it, I'll do stand-up." It was high intelligence perverted for purely mischievous ends. I've seen a few funny people in my time, and I can tell you there was never a one like this. After the show, while I was still gasping for air, we met and went across the street for a meal that started a lifelong friendship. Life would never be the same again. In conversation, he was so fast you could barely get a thought out before he would seize it, gloss it, show you the opposite, turn it upside down, show you the left and right of it, run multiple variations on it, and then, properly examined, hand it back to you. It was like Mozart improvising on a theme. In the fall of 1980, around the time we played the Hollywood Bowl, Tanya and I visited him and his first wife Valerie in rustic Topanga Canyon amongst their goats. Soon afterwards, Robin took me on a wild comedy ride that went from large clubs to small clubs to extremely tiny clubs in both L.A. and San Francisco. He never stopped. Every night, he had to work out. Along the way, there would be refueling stops at rich mansions where powerful people bent over powdered mirrors. For it was the time of cocaine, mountains of it. He would burst on the scene, reduce them to laughter, hit them up for some lines, and we would be off. Finally, in front of as few as 6 startled customers in some seedy comedy club, he would bounce on stage at 3 in the morning to excite and ignite, to hit and run, and leave them wondering what just happened. Pity the poor young comic he had just preempted, and left in his wake to follow him. He was not always popular amongst comedians, because sometimes, while ad-libbing, he would remember someone else's lines. But no one could doubt his status. Finally, toward dawn, he would run out of clubs. The coke had by then conclusively clogged his mind. He would cease to be funny, and we could slink off to roost. We spent a lot of time together before he finally trusted me enough that he didn't have to be funny every second. I could write a novel about him. In fact, I did. The Road to Mars. When it was published, Steve Martin wrote the best ever blurb. I laughed, I cried, and then I read the book. When Robin and Valerie came to stay with us in France, Mork and Mindy was the most popular show on American TV, and Robin could go nowhere without being mobbed. In France, he was completely anonymous. He couldn't believe it. He stood in open disbelief in the middle of a Provençal fête, amazed and thrilled that not a single soul recognized him. Finally, he jumped up and down in the middle of the dance floor, yelling, I'm Mork! I'm Mork! Nobody turned a hair. The French danced by with hardly a Gallic shrug at this crazy foreigner. The freedom of anonymity is what you lose most with fame. I told him it's very important to get away from it all, so your life isn't just showbiz. There's got to be a place where you can be you. It's vital not to lose that sense of yourself, and to get away from time to time so you know who you are. Seeing our French hideaway encouraged him to buy a country place for himself up in Napa. He even managed to escape the shackles of alcohol and cocaine shortly after John Belushi overdosed in a bungalow at the Chateau Marmont. What a terrible waste of a great talent. So many more gifted young comedians would follow. Robin had been one of the last people to visit John and see him alive that night. Now, a grand jury was investigating. Time to clean up. No drugs, no alcohol. Robin only became funnier. Shelley Duvall asked me to write and direct the premiere episode of Fairy Tale Theatre for cable TV, and Robin played a frog for me, which won me a Cable Ace Award. I wrote the tale of the Frog Prince for Robin as the eponymous amphibian and Terry Garr as a petulant princess. One morning on set I saw Robin in his frog mask with huge tears in his eyes, reading in Daily Variety that Mork and Mindy was being cancelled after 5 years. Nice executive touch, that. Shall we tell him? Nah, let's just put it in the papers. He was very upset, and he gathered the crew around him and just let go on ABC. He was hilarious and brilliant, deeply hurt and dressed as a frog. And he just let it all out, trashing the network, lambasting the executives, naming the names, and taking no prisoners. 10 minutes in which he killed us with his wit, scraped out every last scrap of resentment for our laughter, turned all the hurt inside out with the truth exposed, so that at the end he was whole again and ready to work. What better example of the healing power of comedy? I had the pleasure of introducing him to Peter Cook at our London house at a dinner party on April the 7th, 1992. Here's the cast list. Eric and Tanya Idle, Robin Williams, Barbara Hershey, Gary and Michelle Lineker, Charles and Kay Saatchi, Lynn and Peter Cook. I almost wrote casualty list, for many of us nearly died. None of us could eat. We could hardly breathe. It was the big bang of comedy. The funniest and most original Brit meets the funniest and most original American. They were so hilarious they sucked all the air out of the room. Comedy kills, they say. That night we were lucky to survive. Billy Connolly, who himself comes close to the title, said Peter Cook was the funniest man in the world. Robin certainly challenged them both. Often I would go shopping with him in Beverly Hills, because he was a clothes freak, and he would swish around the stores, being outrageously gay. "Oh, Eric, that is so you. It goes with your eyes. Red." He reduced shopkeepers to helpless giggles. He did it again with me shopping for shoes in Florence, speaking fluently in cod Italian, and then spending 10 minutes on Michelangelo in a little old Russian voice.
"So this is David? What, he can't afford underpants?"
He came to visit us in Rome when we were filming Terry Gilliam's epic misadventures of Baron Munchausen at Cinecittà. The production was a legendary disaster. We were all suffering. The arrival of Robin cheered us all up, and amazingly, Terry persuaded him to come back and play the part Sean Connery had just abandoned. His managers didn't want him to do it, so he appeared under a pseudonym, Ray Di Tutto. This was great news for our little gang of actors. We had been suffering from Valentina Cortesi, an Italian actress of the old school. No matter what the scene or what we had rehearsed, on hearing the word action, she always headed directly for the camera and the centre of the shot, shoving everyone out of her way. Poor, adorable 17-year-old Uma Thurman, in her first film, was constantly being pushed aside by a very determined Valentina. Robin, who is by no means easily upstaged, instantly arrested this tendency by plonking his foot firmly on the hem of her costume so she couldn't move, and then shoving a peach in her mouth so she couldn't speak. Oh, how we applauded! One weekend we escaped on what we called the Big Jobby Tour, named after a Billy Connolly routine about a floating turd. And I drove Robin, his wife Marcia, and Tanya in my fab Citroën CX Turbo from Rome to Sorrento with improv all the way. We got lost and ended up accidentally in a funeral cortege in some little village, crawling along behind the mourners. "Don't laugh," said Robin. "It's Don Corleone." He gave us a misguided tour of the deserted ruins of Pompeii in his flamboyant, phony Italian, leaving our real guide doubled over, gasping for air.
"You see, there's no roofs on any of these houses because it was so very hot that they never finished building anything. They never finished building the whole city because all they do is have sex all the time."
We took a horse-drawn carriage tour of Sorrento, where the horse was so skinny that Robin suggested we put it in the carriage while we pulled. Next day we took the chairlift to the top of Capri and gazed across the Bay of Naples at Mount Vesuvius. Of course, we took a boat into the Blue Grotto, where even the boatman became hysterical as Robin improvised Tiberius encouraging his naked nymphs to nibble on his testicles in mad Italian. It was a wonderful weekend, but then it was back to the chaos of Cinecittà, where each week our drivers became better dressed and drove newer cars. Someone was making money. At first it was fun driving past the Colosseum on the way to work, but soon it turned into a nightmare that lasted 6 months. I had my head shaved every morning, and then 3 hours of makeup. Gilliam swore to me he would shave his head if I did, but the minute I did, he reneged, the bastard. Often the cast would get made up and then be told, "Oh no, they wanted the younger version." Back for another 3 hours of makeup. Munchausen was a long and difficult shoot. I said I'd rather go back to boarding school, but Terry has the most amazing stamina and willpower, and how he kept it together, I have no idea. Seeing him recently, I realized he's only happy in chaos, and he made me laugh so much talking about directing while incontinent with a catheter on his latest film, Don Quixote, which he had amazingly just finished. He laughed at his own folly, but he's still the funny, crazy Terry Gilliam I've known all these years, although he does seem to attract trouble. Robin taught me the meaning of private jet lag. We were always off on holidays or cruises to the West Indies, to the Bahamas, to Venice and to Greece. Occasionally, we would have some nice private times together when he could be just sweet and serious. I can remember swimming ashore with him from a boat in the Aegean. It was a lot farther than we thought, and we both struggled. We hugged as we finally reached the beach, always a bit too far out. Once for his birthday, he picked me up in his jet from Montreal and flew me to Paris, just the two of us. We shopped, we dined, and we went to the Crazy Horse. He was scared Marcia would find out, and I said, "Don't worry, she will, because I'm going to tell her. We're looking, not shopping." Next day was the final day of the Tour de France, where for the last two laps we had the unbelievable treat of being in the little red Renault that is the lead car, a seat usually reserved for presidents, but on this day filled with three very excited men, me, Robin, and Michael J. Fox. It was the most exciting thing I've done with my pants on. The lead riders were 8 yards behind us, sprinting up the Champs-Élysées. We couldn't believe we were that close. We screamed and yelled like 10-year-olds. It was the best seat for any sport ever. As we passed the Louvre and headed down into the tunnel, 100 riders were pedalling hard behind us for the final bell. As we climbed out of the little red Renault, totally exhilarated, Michael J. Fox said, "We will always have Paris." Robin took me to the Tour de France 3 times, and we always had fun. He excelled at cycling and would go riding with Lance Armstrong's team on their day off. It was sad about Lance. The French always said he was cheating. 7 tours in a row? Robin and I were computer geeks, and both of us used the same Toshiba dealer in Beverly Hills. One day, I was in the shop, and I heard the guy answer the phone. "Oh, hello, Robin." I could tell by the tone it was the Robin. I said to the guy, "Let me talk to him," and he handed me the phone. So I started talking in a very cod, over-the-top, comic Indian accent. "Hello, who is this, please?" "Oh, Mr. Williams. Oh, yes, sir. This is Ramsheed, sir. I understand you have a problem." Oh, yes, I can help you. No problem. What is the issue?" Robin is speaking in a serious little boy voice because he really wants help. His hard drive has crashed and he's lost all sense of humour. He explains what has gone wrong while I say, Oh, yes. Oh, dear. "Well, I am thinking you are having problems with your Ram Dass Datbat file." Yes, sir, your Ram Dass Datbat file. It's under the Dis Dat Rom Bat file. But can you see the Dos Dat Dot Rom Com file?" "You can't find it." "Okay, let's look for it in the P file." "The P file. You don't have a P file. Oh dear, well, we can make one. But first of all, I want to try a little test, sir. I have a quick fix that may just work. Put one hand on your computer." "Yes, right. Now take your other hand and touch the wall." "Yes, stretch out and touch it. This gives better grounding, sir, for the electrostatic, which may be part of the problem. So, now you're touching the wall? Good. Now I want you to take your hand off the wall and just very quickly touch your bottom." "Yes, sir, near the buttocks." "Yes, sir, this will discharge some of the electrostatic build-up. It's what we call the Bombay fix." "Yes, sir, the Bombay fix. By the way, do you know who you're talking to?" "No, sir, this is not Ramsheed, sir. This is your friend Mr. Idle, and I just got you." A howl of anguish on the other end, and Robin laughed for 5 minutes. We spent wonderful family holidays at the Connolly's lovely Scottish home, Cander Craig, just a fart away from Balmoral. Billy and his wife Pamela organised Cayleys, Scottish dancers, where young and old danced together after dinner, and we wore kilts and went to the Lonnock, the local Highland Games, where Robin joined the fastest and toughest for the gruelling 3-mile hill climb, and always finished in the top 10. On the morning of the Lonnock, an entire company of armed Scotsmen with pikes and kilts marched up the drive behind a bagpipe band. It was a tremendous sight. While we all watched, Billy would take the salute from the wonderful Sir Hamish, who had escaped from Colditz Castle in World War II. Then they would all be given a dram of whiskey, salute, and march back down the drive to another 12 large houses. Behind them there followed an attendant with a small donkey cart to collect those who could not take the whiskey. They would enter the arena later, proudly proclaiming, "There is nae one in the cart!" With some of the funniest people in the world staying just up the road, Prince Charles would sometimes call up and say, "Billy, I hear you have some interesting people staying. Can I come to dinner?" One night, at Billy's dinner table, with Judy Dench and Prince Charles, there was a heated conversation about the movie Mrs. Brown, and whether or not Queen Victoria had actually slept with Mr. Brown. Two said yes. Billy, who played Mr. Brown, thought yes, while Judy Dench was adamant. "I'm sure they did." Only one insisted the answer was no. But then, for the naysayer, she was his great-great-great-grandmother. I think I trust the actors on this, and since the main job of royals is shagging, to produce an heir and a spare, I imagine they've become quite good at it. Queen Victoria apparently was very fond of it. She had 9 children. So, in Scotland, at the castle of the Connollys, young and old had fabulous and hilarious times. I dubbed their court Pamelot, because it was all organised by the amazing, now appropriately lady, Pamela Connolly. I emailed Billy recently, congratulating him on his knighthood. He wrote back, "Dear Eric, as you rightly observed, I was knighted this morning, and in my new position as Knight of the Realm, I've decided that I will no longer squander my good time by hanging out with scruff like you, so you can fuck off. Famous comedian and friend of the great, Sir Billy Connolly, CBE, unbearable shit, don't you forget it." I accepted his kind invitation to fuck off. He always gave us the best of times. Once they flew us all to Fiji to celebrate Billy's 60th birthday. The first year we went to Scotland, I wrote and recorded a song called Canda Craig with Peter Asher, in order to thank them. Steve Martin played banjo, and Robin ended up ranting in a Scottish voice about the colon and clogging effects of haggis. "Haggis, nature's way of saying slow down." I was asleep when Eddie Izzard called me from the Edinburgh Festival to tell me that Robin was gone. I'd been trying to get him to come over to London to do the final night of the Python show at O2 and be our guest celebrity in blackmail. But he wrote back, anxiously begging off. I should have guessed something was up. Robin not wanting to perform? "Listen," I wrote to him, "you don't have to come on stage. Just come here for our last show." But he didn't. And now he was gone. Forever. It was hardly 3 years since we had danced at his wedding to the lovely Susan. He seemed so happy. "Eric," he said to me, "I have finally found my Tanya. And now this." I went through all the emotions, shock, denial, disbelief, anger, guilt. Could I have done something? Could anyone have done something? I knew he was depressed, but then who knew how badly? The manner of his death was so awful. His suicide seemed inexplicable, until finally an autopsy revealed that he'd been suffering from an unusually severe case of Lewy body dementia. In the months before his death, Robin was besieged by paranoia, and so confused he couldn't remember his lines while filming a movie. He was wrongly diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and the telltale signs of Lewy body dementia in his brain were not discovered until the autopsy. Now all we have left are memories. It was too sudden, too soon, and too awful. At his memorial that September in San Francisco, my daughter Lily and I sang a little song for him. "Good night, Robin. Thanks for all the laughs." It still doesn't seem real. I can't bear it. It's too fucking sad. Shortly afterwards, Mike Nichols died, and then Gary Shandling, and then Carrie Fisher. It was all too much. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Chapter 31. Together again at last, for the very first time. Shortly after the Python farewell, John Cleese asked me if I would interview him for Writer's Block Presents at the Alex Theatre Glendale about his new autobiography, So Anyway. Of course I would, though I read his book with some trepidation. We're all pretty good at giving out stick. One of the tabloids has insisted for many years we all hate each other, despite all evidence to the contrary, so when it came to this final chapter about the O2 farewell, I was a little concerned. What might John say about me? I needn't have worried. He gushed. I blushed to read what he had written. It was the kindest and most personal review I've ever read, from someone who means the most. John's book event at Glendale was sold out. 1,400 eager fans were waiting, and the black market price was over a couple of $100 each. I know, because I sold them. John and I met up at the stage door of the Alex, our tall daughters immediately bonding backstage. "What on earth are we going to do?" I asked him. "Oh, just go on, we'll be funny." We walked straight on, bowed, and then walked straight off again. It was footlights time. We sat in two red comfy chairs and began to chat. 2 hours flew by. Memories, anecdotes, jokes. John even threw some sketches at me to cold read with him. The audience loved it. I loved it. Our daughters loved it. I had known this man since 1963, and here we were back on stage simply chatting. In February 2013, on the anniversary of our meeting, I had written a blog about our 50 years together. I think it was the first time he read what I really felt about him. I'm not sure he knew before. He called the next day and talked animatedly on the phone for an hour. Now we could be both touching and funny about each other on stage. And more important, we could be on the road together for months, because our 2-hour Glendale chat went out on the internet and picked up such a tremendous response that John asked me if I'd be interested in touring Florida with him. Sure, why not? I'd never been to Florida. This was pre-Mar-a-Lago time, and the alligators hadn't yet come in to drain the swamps. With the prospect of some fine fall weather and some pleasant places to visit, we could find an audience who were even older than we were. We called the show John Cleese and Eric Idle together again at last for the very first time. And we based it on our first encounter in Glendale, adding some less familiar sketches from the 1948 show, inserting plenty of funny clips, and telling our joint story. We claimed to have met at Trump University and gone on from there. In the second act, we separated. John did some of his solo tour material, and then I came on and sang some tasteless songs. Oddly, this was the first time I'd ever sung a solo set with just me and a guitar. What, no band? And so it was in line with my own belief that you must always be trying something new. We finished the show together, doing Q&A, ad-libbing happily with the audience before we ended with Brightside. I love being back on stage doing sketches with John. We could both make each other laugh, and I'm afraid we did. We giggled a lot through Florida. Towards the end of our tour, we engaged a large rock and roll bus, and it was great fun riding around reading, writing, kipping, and occasionally sipping champagne. We went north into the Carolinas and Georgia, ending up in Baltimore on Halloween night. Tanya visited several times. Lily came to Orlando for a Harry Potter binge. Our crew were kind and very helpful, and Simon Garner, an incredibly considerate Canadian gentleman, was the perfect tour manager. My favourite time was somewhere in Carolina, when we had a large and very funny lady signing for the partially hearing. I'd begun to sing, "Isn't it awfully nice to have a penis?" when I suddenly glanced at her and recognised the hand gestures she was making. Unmistakable dick signs. I giggled. The audience, following my look, began to laugh too. Since the entire song is just a series of dick synonyms, I turned to face her and continued singing directly to her. I tried desperately not to crack up as she found more and more elaborate hand gestures for that particular part of the male anatomy. She won. I collapsed in hysterics. She got an enormous round of applause from the audience. She was so funny, I wanted to take her with us. The whole tour went so well and CAA paid so well that John called a month later and asked me if I'd like to join him touring Australia and New Zealand. Hell yeah. So off we flew to summer in Sydney, everyone's favourite winter destination. After some promo where John and I slipped easily into banter mode, I flew up to visit my son in the rainforest. He does have a house, but it sounds nicer like that. In fact, it couldn't be nicer. Carrie practices Tibetan medicine on the Sunshine Coast and gave me a lot of meals and acupuncture. I once told him he'd let me down becoming a healer, as I'd been hoping for a crack dealer. One of the funniest things he did was when the Dalai Lama visited the Chinrezig Institute, the nearby Buddhist centre, Carey made a huge shrubbery with a plaque, which to this day says, "Shrubbery, sponsored by Eric Idle and family for H.H. the Dalai Lama visit." Carey drove me to Surfers Paradise for our opening show, and then we went on to Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. In Canberra, we stayed for 2 nights in the wonderful Jamala Wildlife Lodge, where John and I had tea with a tiger and bravely petted the cheetah. Then on to Perth, Adelaide and Wellington, where for our final show, I played a gag on John. On a previous tour, he had dubbed Palmerston North the suicide capital of New Zealand. The locals were offended, but in 2006, encouraged by Fred Dagg, the pseudonymous character of John Clark, a famous local comedian, they rather wittily named their rubbish dump after John, putting up an official sign at the Palmerston North refuse tip which says Mount Cleese. On the drive to Wellington, I diverted and made a short film of me climbing it, with which I surprised him on the final night. I'm happy to say I'm the first python to conquer Mount Cleese, and even Michael Palin hasn't been there. After New Zealand, Tanya and I flew home via Tahiti, where thanks to the vagaries of the international dateline, I celebrated 3 birthdays. I don't have to add them all on, do I? Soon John was back on the phone. This time he proposed a big US tour all the way from Vancouver, down the West Coast, through LA, San Diego, 2 nights in Vegas, on down through Arizona to El Paso, across the whole of Texas, ending up in New Orleans. Naturally, we had a bus, and a spiffy one at that, but we actually slept in Four Seasons hotels. It was rough, I'm telling you. Before we left on this tour, I recorded a TV show for the BBC with my pal Professor Brian Cox. He had been gently educating me in the mysteries of science since we met on What About Dick? And of course, I turned my learnings into a musical. With songs by John Dupre and choreography by the incomparable Arlene Phillips, we were back at the Beeb, making another Rutland Weekend television special only 41 years later. The entire universe in 1 hour as a musical is exactly that. It was broadcast on Boxing Day on BBC Two, and again a year later when we sold it to PBS. It's a simple gag. Professor Brian comes in late from Patagonia, where he has been studying electromagnetism for a month, and hence out of cell phone range, to join Robin Ince in the studio at Elstree. He thinks he's coming in to give a simple lecture on the physics of the universe, but no. In the meantime, Arlene and I have changed it into a musical. A serious scientist trapped in a musical is a gag I like, and my proudest moment was getting Brian to climb into full drag to illustrate the infinite possibilities of the multiverse. A universe of infinitely extending universes. Weren't we small enough? I can't think of many double professors of science who would uncomplainingly climb into a red frock to illustrate a scientific principle. Perhaps it's our Oldham connection. Superbly complimented by Warwick Davis, the cast starred Hannah Wanningham, our First Lady of the Lake from Spamalot in the West End, and the brilliantly funny Noel Fielding, from the whimsically hilarious show The Mighty Boosh. I don't think I can describe it, except as a nutty show with science, song and dance, Albert Einstein, the Bee Gees singing about gravity, and a real astronaut, spacewalker Tim Peake, who had just returned from 6 months on the International Space Station. We ended up singing the Galaxy Song, with Professor Hawking himself singing at the end. The show was great fun to do before a live audience, but no sooner completed than I dashed off to join John Cleese on our big tour of the USA. I liked the shape of the show we already had going, the double autobiography, but I wondered why we couldn't just pick up and continue our story after the intermission, with the various Python breakups and all the coming back together such as Brian, The Meaning of Life, Aspen and O2. Even though it meant quite a bit of work, John thought that was a good idea. And we tried out this new act too for a few nights in Victoria on Vancouver Island, where it immediately worked a lot better. I also wrote a new song to open the show, Fuck Selfies, which at least warned people where we stood. Fuck selfies and all those stupid gits who want selfies. They just get on my tits. Fuck grinning like a lunatic with people you don't know. It takes them half an hour to get their fucking phones to go. And then another 14 other people fucking show. So tell those selfish selfie pricks, next time they bloody ask, to take their fucking selfie sticks and shove them up their arse. It's our kindness and sweetness people like. Now that the whole show had a shape, it was more satisfactory. It had a narrative, a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was our entwined life stories, plus a tale of Monty Python from start to finish. Mike Nichols would have been proud. We had a blast on the road. We played a very strange hockey arena in Canada, which was predictably freezing. The show was going incredibly well. The dates flew by, and soon I was home in L.A. with 2 days off for the presidential election. It was supposed to be the triumph of the first woman president of the United States. But unfortunately, Putin had other ideas. With the unexpected and unwelcome election of Donald J. Trump, our show became therapy. At Thousand Oaks Civic Arts Plaza, the night after, the audience was still grieving. Laughter was tremendously important to them now. They laughed 3 times harder than before and sang along to Brightside with fervor. It was never more needed. I sang it with John on Conan, where I made a genuine ad-lib live on the show when I sang, "When you're feeling in the dumps, forget about the Trumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing." Sometimes jokes are just staring at you in the face, and that was one occasion. For the rest of the tour, we sang that, and the audience would cheer. The resistance was beginning. Across America, our show was sad, glum people coming out to be cheered up and set free by laughter. And really, laughter is the only sane response to pathological lying. For 2 packed nights at the MGM Grand, we played Vegas, baby, staying in suites that were bigger than most private houses. In Arizona, Alice Cooper came backstage to say hello. He even invited us to Thanksgiving, which was most kind, but we had to move on. Texas was waiting. And after hooking up with old friends in Houston and playing all the blue cities, we flew to New Orleans for our final show. John and I had a final farewell lunch amongst the Christmas decorations, while outside a parade of leprechauns dressed as green Elvises with pointy ears and black pompadours drove past on scooters. We'd done 3 chores in very quick succession and were still friends. In the southeast of the states, we'd played 20 shows to 38,000 people. In our second tour to Australia and New Zealand, we'd played 9 shows in 7 cities to 36,000 people. And in our final US tour, we'd played 34 shows in 23 cities to 62,000 people. Our combined age was 150. Chapter 32, Brexit Through the Gift Shop. After George introduced me to her in 1975, I got to see Joni Mitchell occasionally over the years. We spent New Year's Eve 2016 side by side in wheelchairs, and recently she came to my 75th birthday when my son was there. "Come on, Carrie, get out your cane." One day I said to her, "You have to think of our generation as the survivors on the raft of the Medusa. One by one, we slide off the raft into the jaws of the waiting sharks." I was trying to cheer her up. What I meant was, the end is inevitable. You have to embrace your fellow time travellers even as they slip away. Ours was an extraordinary generation, born into a devastated world, exhausted from 6 years of total war. 60 million died. Nowadays, the young think times are tough if they can't get an internet connection. They're right, times are tough, but there was a time before it all began to go to shit when it all really was shit. Our generation was born into that time. It was called World War II. We heard the sirens in the night and put on our foul-smelling Mickey Mouse gas masks and went down into the Anderson shelters. It was very loud and very terrifying. Then it stopped, for a bit. That was the gap in time our generation lived in. We thought we were hard done by, but we were wrong. We were lucky. We wouldn't have to march off to war. The peacetime conscription of the National Service stopped just before I was due to be enlisted. Senior boys at my boarding school would turn pale at breakfast as their call-up papers arrived. But it mercifully ended a few years before my turn. Phew. Not so good for the Yanks, of course. They were even more fucked over by Vietnam, and poor Gilliam had to serve his time in the New York Armory, where he would eventually film Robin Williams in The Fisher King. But from the bomb sites and the rations